Welcome to today's webinar. This is the virtual advising session for awards to the Western Hemisphere. So everything from Canada to Chile, the Caribbean islands, etc., Central America. So we are doing a very kind of informal session today. I hope you have your questions ready. I will be sharing my screen in terms of the application, the website, and different awards if you have any questions. The first few slides will be going through some of the basics of the program. But before I begin, I should introduce myself. My name is Michelle Valerci, and I'm an outreach and recruitment specialist here at the Institute of International Education. I'm based in Washington, D.C. And I'm joined by, over the phone, my colleague Angelica Cerna, a program officer for the Western Hemisphere, is also on the line. And she will also be able to answer some questions that come through. This session today, over the next hour, we really want to ensure that we get to as many questions as possible. We have a large number of people on the call today on the webinar, and so I'd like to begin and get to those questions. Just real quick, if you're tuning in for the first time, if you're new to Fulbright webinars and the Scholar program, the Scholar program is geared towards professionals and academics and independent scholars, researchers, professionals from all fields to conduct research and teach abroad. So if you are a recent graduate with a bachelor's or a master's degree, and you're also looking for opportunities to conduct research or study, I would direct you to the Fulbright Student Program. It's called the Fulbright Student Program, but you're not required to be a student at the time of application. All right, so going back to the mission of the program and the brief bit of history, the Fulbright Program has been around. We'll be celebrating our 75th anniversary next year, so we're very excited to look forward to that and the celebrations next year. But this program is really to foster mutual understanding and to bring people together across cultures, across nations, etc. And we have partnered with 160 countries around the world to accomplish this, to allow academics and professionals from all backgrounds to study, conduct research, and teach around the world, and for those professionals and academics to come to the U.S. and do the same. So it's definitely bilateral in nature. It is the U.S. government's flagship educational and cultural exchange program, and it is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State, and the Institute of International Education administers the program. We also have a lot of funding that comes in through the partner countries, so you'll notice a lot of awards are partnered at particular institutions or universities because they are also funding the program partly. The diversity and inclusion statement here is actually directly from the U.S. Department of State. This is at the core of Fulbright outreach strategy and the recruitment strategy, and they would like to ensure that everyone is aware that if they are eligible and meet the requirements, that they encourage them to apply. So we are really looking for, on a year-to-year basis, every time we have the competition open, we are looking to ensure that the cohort of Fulbrighters truly reflects the U.S. society. So opportunities are open to people regardless of their background, their race, color, socioeconomic status, disability, etc. We do have also a partnership with MIUSA and the National Disability Clearinghouse. So if you have a disability, visible or not visible, they have resources and they've partnered with Fulbright. So we do have a lot of partner organizations that work with Fulbright to ensure everybody has access to the program. And just to give you a snapshot of the numbers, the Fulbright U.S. Scholar Program is quite vast, and Fulbright in general is a very large set of programs. So you've probably heard of Fulbright for, you know, doctoral students, for postdocs, for scholars, researchers. So specifically today we're talking about the opportunities for scholars and administrators, and annually we award 800 grants. So there are several opportunities to choose from, and among those 800 grants they belong to about 450 unique award opportunities. And the Western Hemisphere makes up a sizable number of those opportunities. In terms of the baseline eligibility for the U.S. Scholar Program, U.S. citizenship is required. After that, it really depends on the award description. So the award descriptions that you'll see for one country might differ significantly with another. For example, Canada may or may not require a PhD for some of their awards, but let's say Mexico would require a PhD, for example. So it's very important to check the award descriptions to ensure what kind of applicant they're looking for. They might state that they're open to early career applicants, whereas another award to the same country is specifically for senior scholars. So again, no two awards are alike, and no, even within the same country. So again, there are a lot of different opportunities for postdocs up to senior scholars and everybody in between. And I should also mention, if you've had a Fulbright in the past and you're looking to reapply to the program, we ask that you wait 2 years in between the time your grant ends until the time you reapply. And if you'd like more information, please do view the eligibility requirements online. All right, so before we get to the questions, I want to ensure that everyone is aware of the application components and what we're seeking in the application. So the next couple of slides are going to focus on that, and then we'll open it up to questions. So in terms of what we require in the application, the online application form is where you're going to start. And I encourage you, if you haven't started already, to begin the application as soon as possible, because you can work on it as long as you'd like, and you just save as you go. The deadline is now about, 2.5 months away, almost 2 months. So September 15th is coming up, but you again have plenty of time if you haven't started. Aside from the application form, there are several documents that you will need to upload to the form. The first one is the project statement. And the project statement is 3 to 5 pages, and that's really where you're going to put what you propose in writing. After that, we also need your CV or your resume. Again, that has a page limit, 6 pages. We require, this year we're only asking for 2 letters of recommendation. In the past, it was 3. So it's important to really choose wisely as to who can best speak about your teaching or your research experience. And we do have guidance online, I'll show you where you can find that, about who you should think about if you're strictly proposing to teach on a Fulbright, if you're strictly proposing to research on a Fulbright, or if you're proposing to do a combination of teaching and research, then what kind of letters should you seek? The language proficiency report, if it's required, is something that is also added to your application once the external evaluator completes the form. So the way that works is similar to the letters of recommendation. Once you log in and create your application, you will then register your recommenders as well as your language proficiency evaluator. You would fill their name in, their email, and then click submit under that. And that would generate an automatic mail from our system to their emails. So be sure that they check not only their inbox, but if they don't see it, they should check their spam or their junk folder just in case, because it will say IIE or Fulbright in the title, and it might not go straight to their inbox. So be sure to follow up with them once you've submitted their information in the system. Last but not least, in terms of the requirements, is the letter of invitation. Again, that could be optional depending on the award that you're applying to, but I would say at least half of the awards in the catalog do require an invitation letter from the potential host or the affiliation that you've identified. So that must be also uploaded. Now, that's something that you would be able to upload. That letter can be sent to your email from the host. It can be addressed to you, and that's something you would upload. All right. Now, in terms of supplemental materials, it really depends on your profile and what you're proposing to do. The syllabi or the course outlines are required if you are proposing some kind of teaching. In other words, even if it's just 20% teaching and 80% research, if there is a teaching component officially in the grant activity, we do expect to have 2 to 3 outlines or syllabi. And that has a page limit of 10 pages. So if you're providing 3, you're really going to have to pare it down to about 3 pages each. Just remove all of the boilerplate information that you would have for attendance policies and plagiarism. All of that is not required. We really want to see what are you proposing to teach and what kind of course materials do you have in mind. In terms of the bibliography, this is again for any research component to your proposal. We get a lot of questions about the bibliography. The guidance is on our website, and it clearly states that it can be a list of not only things that you've published, but also anything that reflects the current state of that research topic. So the state of the art needs to be reflected in the bibliography. Now, if you're an artist or a musician, or you're kind of, you know, not in the traditional realm of the bibliography being published articles and books, if it's exhibitions, if it's installations, performances, all of that should be listed there. Because the project statement is only 3 to 5 pages, we do not require you to provide in-text citations, endnotes, or footnotes. And I know if, you know, for those of you that are academics, this will probably bother you greatly, but we really want you to focus on the nitty-gritties and the details in the project statement. All of the citations and all of your resources and references can be left for the bibliography. That's a 3-page limit. And then finally, if you're from the arts or journalism, creative writing, we ask that you submit a small portfolio, and details are in the application. All right, so moving on. Now, the project statement, I'm going to just briefly discuss because we've recently created a video tutorial, and it's on our website. I'll show you where you can access it, but if you click on Project Statement Guidelines on our website, you'll find it. It's a very useful tool, I think. It's just a 10-minute video, and it'll really walk you through the process of what Fulbright is looking for in a project statement. Keep in mind, what we're looking for differs greatly from other funding agencies. Again, the mission of the program is to bring people together through research and education. So since it is funded by the State Department, at the core of the program is public diplomacy. So keep in mind that your project statement needs to be understood not only by people in your discipline, but also by a generalist, somebody maybe working at the embassy or the committee that the commission in that country has convened. So please do not use any jargon, graphs, tables, charts, images. Nothing should be additional other than the text. It should be clear to anybody who picks up your proposal what you hope to do, how you hope to do it, why it's important, and why you are selecting that country, why it's relevant, and why you're the best fit to carry out this project. Aside from that, in the application form, we do ask some questions about your interest in the Fulbright program and your adaptability and things like that. So you really need to focus in on, you know, the details of your proposal, the timeline. If you have a timeline, please add that. If you're doing a flex project, we need to see month by month what you'll be doing on the ground, and also the impacts and outcomes that you anticipate, not only for the host country or the host institution, but also for your home institution and for you and your career. So we really want to see this come full circle, and the multiplier effect should be quite evident, not that the Fulbright experience ends once you return home. Okay, so those are kind of the key pieces of advice I'd like to give about the project statement. Now, if we take a look at the award, for those of you that are new to joining us in the webinars and online, please take a look. This is a sample award description, and it's important that you read all 4 of the tabs. The awards detail tab has a lot of information that's important, but the award requirements tab showcases contact information and letter of invitation requirements, as well as the language proficiency requirements. So oftentimes we get a lot of questions that are actually clearly stated in the award description. So keep in mind, once you've selected the award that you're applying to, and you can only select one, It's important that you know the award description inside and out, because you will really need to tailor your project statement to what the award is seeking. And you will need to understand the goal of the award, the potential hosts that are involved, and really ensure that you are matching up your project, your profile, to the award. I've pointed out another part of the award that's quite important. A lot of people don't click on it until they're actually ready to start the application, but I encourage you to click on it because it brings you to all of the resources that I've mentioned earlier about guidance. So the begin application process, that button on the right corner of the award description, is your key to finding all of the guidance and information, the review criteria, essentially the rubric that the reviewers use when they convene the committees. All of that is there. So I'll be showing that to you once I move on to the website. Just a little note about the affiliation or the invitation letters. Again, about half of the awards require an invitation letter, and then the other half are a little divided between optional or preferred or should not be sought. So there are some awards in the Western Hemisphere that are placed, and if they're placed and they don't want you to be in contact, they will say a letter should not be sought. So you should not intervene in that matter. The proposal would then, you know, be considered without any kind of negotiation with the host. Now, keep in mind, an invitation letter is a non-binding expression of interest. There could be several invitations that are given to applicants that request them. So it doesn't mean that you've been accepted. It means that they're interested in what you propose to do. Ideally, unless stated in the award, it should come from the person that you hope to collaborate with. They should detail what you're planning to do while you're there, how they'll be collaborating with you, any kind of facilities that the institution is willing to allow you to access, such as office space, the lab, the library, those kind of things. There is no cost typically associated with becoming a Fulbrighter. There might be one or two awards that require some cost sharing, but I would say 99% of the awards do not require that. So if you're contacting an institution and they need to know, they'd like to know more details about what their costs would be, let them know that you're applying through the Fulbright and that the stipend that you receive from Fulbright should cover your living expenses and things like that. Last but not least, the invitation letter should come on institutional letterhead. And that, again, is something that you can upload directly to the application form. If you are applying to an award that has multiple hosts, or let's say more than one country, so the Carlos Rico Award allows you to conduct research in Canada and Mexico. So you need an invitation from both the host in Canada as well as the host in Mexico. But the application form only allows you to upload one PDF. Please combine those invitation letters into one PDF file and then upload it. The same is true if you're applying to a country where it's optional and you want to let us know that you have two invitations and you'd be happy to go to either place. If the award allows that, you can again combine both invitations and upload them as one file. Some countries, and I don't know if it's necessarily specific to the Western Hemisphere, I think specifically I'm thinking of another region that allows just if you've got email correspondence, you can upload email correspondence. If you anticipate, let's say you're ready to submit your application next week, you have everything except the invitation letter, and it's optional, you don't know if it's coming, but you have the email correspondence that's unofficially stating that you're welcome to affiliate, you can upload that, and once the invitation letter comes, then just email it to us. So that's fine as well. All right? But we do need to have all of your information uploaded by the deadline. Now, if you anticipate the invitation letter coming in after September 15th, we still need you to submit your application by September 15th, and we need you to let us know what date you anticipate that. We can work with you to a certain degree in receiving a late invitation, but if it's significantly delayed beyond a few weeks, I don't know if we can make any other kind of exception. But please do email us. We'll be looking at these requests on a case-by-case basis. All right, so if you need to contact me for any of the awards in the Western Hemisphere, please email westhem@iie.org. And these are our other handles and ways to connect. And what I'd like to do now is I would like to take a look at our question box. We have about 40 minutes for questions, and then we can go from there. So let's see if we've got some questions coming in. All right. And in the meantime, I'm switching over my screen. We should now be able to see. Yes, all right. Okay. And please note this webinar is being recorded. So if you need to jump off now and would like to tune in later, it will be uploaded to our website within a week. All right, so let me see what questions we've got. I have a question. If I have a JD, can I apply for the Scholar Program? So that's a great question. If you have a terminal degree that is not a PhD, it's a JD or an MFA or something like that, that, and if it's the final degree in your field, that is considered a terminal degree eligible for the Scholar Program. So yes. Now, if you have a JD and you recently graduated this year or last year, you may be a better fit for the student program. If you have a JD and you have at least 5-10 years of experience, then certainly the Scholar Program is where to go. All right, so we have a question about what do the grants cover? So that's a great question. So I'm sharing my screen right now. I'm actually going to go to the awards catalog. And the way I got there is I'm here on CIES.org, and I click on Browse the Awards Catalog. Now I've got that open over here. And before you go in to select the award, I'd like to let you know that if you scroll down, we have a lot of resources available. And the eligibility is outlined here. So if you have resided abroad, we have eligibility about that. Prior Fulbright Awards, if you're affiliated with the State Department or your family is. We also have instructions on different kinds of awards and how to select the right award. If you're curious about the timeline and how things are reviewed, how the applications are reviewed, all of that information is here. I'm going to make my screen bigger. All right. And then the review criteria. If you have questions that you can't find answers to on the website, the FAQs are always a great place to start. And then finally, what do you need to start your application? All of the components are outlined here. Project statement samples, the checklist, and the application instructions. So please do reference all of these. I guarantee you that most all of your questions will be answered by checking these resources. Now, going back to the question about what the stipend covers, let's go back up, and we'll select the Western Hemisphere, and I'm going to click on this award, and here it says for Argentina, the stipend is $4,000 per month, depending on your status. So that would then cover housing and living costs, things like that. There might be some book or research allowance. We can see here they give you $400 for books, which then should be donated to the host institution. Travel or relocation is also included. And then there's a special award benefit to travel within the region for a conference. So other than that, everything that that is provided as a stipend or benefit would be listed here. There's nothing that comes extra beyond that. All right. The next question we have is about the flex. That's a great question. How do I find out if a flex, if a, an award has the flex option? Well, in the award details, when you scroll down, you'll see that the flex option is either listed as a yes or a no. Let's find an award that has the flex option, and then I can show you how that would work. So the Bahamas, for example, there is the flex option. The parameters, however, might be different than the award length if you were to take the months consecutively. So here we see the grant length is 4 months. But for flex, they say please see the flex option. So here we see that it says the minimum length of the grant is 4 months and the maximum is 6 months, and that there can be 2 to 3 grant segments spread over 1 to 2 consecutive years. And the minimum length of any grant segment is 1 month and the maximum is 3 months. So that gives you an idea of how the flex would work. If you propose to do a project with the flex option, you must clearly state why you are requesting the flex, how it lends itself to the project, and what the timeline would look like. So let me actually make my screen a little larger in case. All right, let's go back to some more questions. Are there any grants in Brazil for early career or postdoc? So you can actually find that out by going to, again, let's make this the list. So you can see all of the awards to Brazil here. So there's an All Disciplines Award, and then there are 5 Distinguished Chair Awards, soon to be 7, I believe. We're adding 2 more. The Distinguished Chair Awards are certainly for senior scholars. Let's click on the All Disciplines Award to Brazil to see what level of scholar is eligible to apply. So what I do is on this side I look at the candidate profile, and I notice that it says academics except early career. So this brings up another point. What does Fulbright mean by early career? Early career refers to applicants who have received their PhD within the last 5 years. So if you fall into that category, and it looks like you were looking for a postdoc, you would not be eligible to apply to Brazil. So that's one way of searching. But let's say I know I want to go somewhere in the Western Hemisphere. I want to see what is available to me. I'm a recent graduate or in, you know, early career. Let me now search. And I see from the 61 awards, it narrows it down to 48. And then, of course, I can narrow it down further by discipline, by research activity or teaching activity, by grant length. Let's say I only have 3 months, right? So I can use all of these filters on the left side to narrow down my options even more. And the more you narrow down your options, the easier it will be for you to select an award. Because again, we do have over 450 award opportunities that are unique award opportunities across the world. You can only apply for one award. So that again then becomes quite a challenge to determine which award to apply to. All right. So let's see what the... Okay, we have a question about the syllabi. Should the syllabi be tailored to the courses proposed or just some of the syllabi samples in general? In a way, I would say a little bit of both. Let's say you're proposing to teach 2 courses. One course you have taught in the past, and one course is tailored to that host. In that case, you would need to propose, I would suggest, creating a brand new course syllabus for that course that you're proposing for the host. So the more tailored you can make your project application, the whole application package, the better it will be. And again, if you're providing a sample from a course that you've taught in the past, please don't choose something older than 2 years. Anything older than 2 years, the review committee will say, why hasn't this person provided a fresher syllabus? So you just want to imagine yourself as a reviewer. If you're giving a syllabus from 2015, it doesn't really show that you've freshened things up. So we really want to see the most recent relevant documents in your application. And you should also indicate at the top of the outline of the syllabus which syllabus has been created specifically for that host and which one you've used in the past. So please do differentiate. Okay, we have a question about, let's see, the dependent allowance. I'm applying for a dependent allowance, and will I be less attractive if I add all of my dependents and spouse? No, I don't think that's it. I think the, in fact, Fulbright encourages family members to join where possible. So if there is a dependent allowance, the budget has been factored in for grantees to take their family. And in fact, we've noticed just anecdotally that families who go, you know, go along with the scholar grantee are better integrated in the community and also have a very nice kind of overall community feeling because the kids are in school or the spouse is, you know, kind of working, you know, independently or working from home or something, and there's that kind of community feeling and trying to get integrated with the host community. So certainly do not feel that adding any spouse or dependents would detract from your competitiveness. That's not the case. All right, moving on. Let's go back to some of the first questions that came in. Let's see, if I'm proposing teaching and research, but I'm only going to teach one course, should I attach more than one syllabus? Yes, so that we got to. You do need to have a minimum of 2 to 3 syllabi for a total of 10 pages. All right, let's see what's next. All right, moving on. Okay. Okay, we have a question about Brazil and host institutions. Is there any partner organization that would be helping applicants or finding host universities in Brazil? Well, you can certainly reach out to the commission, the Fulbright Commission.
This is Angelica?
Yeah. Angelica, you want to chime in? Hello? Angelica, we can't hear you right now. So I think there might be some difficulties with Angelica's connection, but Angelica works closely with the commission in Brazil. And if you note, if we open the award to Brazil, for example, we do have the commission linked in the award description. So please feel free to contact the commission in Brazil, and they are best suited to advise you as to potential host institutions. Again, we have the main All Disciplines Award that allows you to select your affiliation, and then the other awards are placed awards at these different institutions, whether it's the Catholic University of Rio Grande do Sul or the University of Sao Paulo, etc. So those are the placed awards. Angelica, are you back on? Okay, maybe not. All right, so moving on back to the questions. Let's see. All right. Okay, got to that one. Do agencies provide letters of invitation for multiple candidates? Okay, we already answered that. I think you mean host institutions. Yes. A host institution can provide multiple letters of invitation for applicants. They don't just give one. So you might be one of many people who've asked. How can you Can you discuss a little bit more about getting an invitation letter? Sure. So if you click on any award and you click on Begin Application Process, they're going to get all of the useful information that I mentioned. And let's see. You scroll down. We have the basic information, or the information on the basic requirements. So the video that I mentioned, if we click on the project statement, this is where you would find that video. So I encourage you to watch that. And then if we go back down here, let's see, this is project statement. Go back to where we were here. The letter of invitation guidance is down here. So you can see all of that here. All right. Moving on to the next question. Okay. Okay, this person. Okay, we have a good question. How do you go about getting, now that we're on the letter of invitation, how do you go about getting the letter? Is it just a cold call or email? Yes, oftentimes it is. And don't be shy about that. So I would say the vast majority of applicants do not have, well, I would say about half of the applicants who apply might have connections abroad in the country that they're applying to, and probably the other half do not. And I work with a lot of applicants who are reaching out to host institutions and countries for the first time, and they do get replies. So my advice to you is, if you haven't heard back, if you approach somebody and you haven't heard back, please do follow up at least once, and then if you, you know, give them enough time, given that everything has kind of changed now in the world. But please do loop us in if you've tried a couple times or three times reaching out and you're not getting anywhere. Forward your email to us, or you can even copy us on the email, and we'll do our best to reach out to our colleagues there to have them reply. But you can also loop in if the commission information or the U.S. Embassy colleagues information is listed in the awards, and the vast majority, in fact, I think all of them list local contact in the award description, whether it's the commission or the embassy colleagues, please do copy them in if you're not getting a response. Okay, we do need to know that. And oftentimes, again, if it's an optional letter of invitation, do not feel that you cannot submit an application. Your application will absolutely be accepted if the letter is optional. All right, so let's see. Moving on, a question about the hosts. Can we work with NGOs, or is it better to find an academic institution? So that actually depends. Let's take a look, and you're going to hear me say this a lot. It really depends on the award that you're applying to. If we look at this award to Argentina, it says any accredited institution of higher education. So then that's quite clear. It needs to be either a university or college or research center that's affiliated as an institution of higher education, something that would be considered accredited. Now, if we move down to, let's say, let me check here. Here, okay, here's another situation where they clearly list all of the potential host institutions. So in this case, a lot of colleges and community colleges. And if we go to, let's see, this might not be the best choice. Yeah, these have, I think it's the one that we want to show would be, for example, I have a good one here. For example, if we click on the Carlos Rico Award for North American Studies, you will see here that the location is listed as any university, government agency, or research institution. So here we have broader parameters. So please do take a look at the award description to see if an NGO would be allowed. but you certainly can affiliate with a non-US, a non-university or college institution if that is outlined in the award description. All right. Another question. Let's see. Let's focus on the affiliations. Yes, okay. Is it possible to have a list of institutions that have hosted Fulbright scholars in the past few years? Yes, and that's the other section of the catalog of the website that I wanted to point out to you. If you're on the home page, below the picture you'll see these tiles. Click on the Fulbright Scholar directory. This directory will give you a list of all of the U.S. and foreign visiting scholars for the past 10 years. So let's click on U.S. scholars. Let's say you're interested in knowing everyone from the U.S. who has gone to Brazil in the past 10 years, all right? And if you actually, you could narrow it down. You say, I'd like to know who went in 2016, and then again in 2017, 18, et cetera. You can select. So let's say I select 3 years and I search. I can then see all of the projects that were accepted and the grantees that went on a grant. So if I click here on the name, I can see who that person was, where they went, where they're from, and what project they did, and where they were based. Now, we don't provide their email contact, but you're more than welcome to contact alumni if you like. And I encourage you to do that if you'd like to seek out more information. We, on the program side, are not able to share the kind of information that they would. They've experienced being on the ground. They've experienced working with the host. They've experienced getting an apartment, enrolling kids in school, et cetera. So the alumni can be a great resource for that. Those kind of questions. All right. Yes, okay. Question about who do we contact for more information. All right. Every single award description has my contact information or my colleague, depending on the country or the region. So all of our contact information is in the bottom right corner. And I also encourage you, if you haven't done so and you have a lot of questions that are easier to answer over the phone rather than email, please join an office hour. That is actually a very instructive, informative way to not only get your questions answered, but hear about others' questions. And, you know, maybe you haven't thought about those kind of things, or, you know, those questions hadn't come into your mind yet. You haven't gotten to that point in the application. So the office hours, I've done them for the past 2 months now, and I've noticed that a lot of people stay on for the full hour. I hold them every Tuesday from 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock Eastern time. And even if you only have one question or even if you don't have any questions and you just want to tune in, it's an informal setting. We don't record it. It's just a kind of an informal chat. And I take your questions from 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock on Tuesday. So the Western Hemisphere email is westhem@iie.org. And I can put that in the chat box so that all of you know who to contact. And that is right here. All right, that's now in the chat box. Great. All right, so moving on. We have about 15 minutes left, so I want to be conscious of getting to all of your questions. We have quite a few people on the line here, and the questions are really coming in, so thank you. All right, we have a question about the language proficiency. Is it necessary to complete a language proficiency test when you are a native language speaker? Well, let's see what the award description says. That's going to be your best friend. So if I click on the award to Mexico, for example, I can see in the award requirements that the letter of the language proficiency is required, and I must have an intermediate level of Spanish. Now, it also says applicants who are native speakers do not need to complete the external evaluation. So in the application online, there's the self-evaluation. You would just need to fill out the self-evaluation. Those of you that are not native speakers and it, where you notice that it is required, you need to enroll a, you need to register an external evaluator. All right, moving on. Let's see. And keep in mind, we're getting a lot of questions about COVID and travel and grant start dates. And I just want everybody to know that the applications that we are soliciting right now, the competition is open for the 2021 fall semester and the spring semester of 2022. Now, many of the awards have some flexibility in start date. So, for example, you can see for this award to Canada, you could either start in September of 2021 or in January of 2022. So potentially a year and a half from now, right? So we're looking at not next, not, you know, not this current upcoming academic year, but the following academic year. So I don't have any guidance as to what will happen. Nobody has a crystal ball for 21 and 22, but the competition is open and we are accepting applications. All right, so let's see, moving on. Okay, let's see. Getting a lot of very specific questions. So I'm noticing a lot of your questions now, there's quite a few that are quite specific to a particular country or award. So I would encourage you to join an office hour and we can go through that specifically. Or you can email me, right? So because I want to make sure that I get to everybody and address the most most commonly asked questions and where I can point you in the right direction. A lot of times you'll find the award description will have the answers that you seek. And again, if you have questions about how to teach, you know, how the teaching would break down or what the host would anticipate, those are discussions that you would need to have with the host. If they are open to you having a different kind of teaching setup where it wouldn't be across the semester, but maybe kind of block seminars or just faculty advising or curriculum development, that counts as teaching. So if you're doing a small percentage of teaching, but you don't anticipate on teaching a full-length semester course, that's something you need to negotiate with the host. So I hope that answered your question. All right. Questions about the timeline, I showed you where you can find that. That is, if we go back to the home page, actually if we go to this, again, begin the application process, the timeline is right here. So we're getting a few questions about that, so you can find that there. Okay, going back to the language requirement, we have a question about who is considered a qualified external evaluator. All right. So I think you're getting the hang of where I'm going to give you that advice. You go back down to this when you clicked on Begin Application Process and the Language Proficiency Guidance, all of it is here. So the person needs to be a qualified language teacher who teaches that language at the college level. All right, let's see, we're down to the last about 9 minutes or so, and I think I've gotten to a good number of questions. Let's see. Okay. We have a question about a matching program with mentor and applicants. So I'm not aware of that, perhaps at the student level, but again, the awards that we're talking about are for academics and professionals. So typically, in this case, you would be the mentor to students in that country. So that's a good point that's brought up. Keep in mind that teaching, and even if you're not doing a teaching component, if you're researching in a particular country, they might ask you to, you know, mentor students or, you know, advise students here and there kind of ad hoc. So be prepared to to share your expertise and advice with graduate students in that particular country, because it's not, sometimes it's not often they get a Fulbrighter. Perhaps it's an institution that hasn't had a Fulbrighter in a while, or they really are looking to have an outside perspective on, you know, contributing to the department. So keep in mind that, you know, part of the program is that you really not only do your project, your research, and the teaching, but you also, you know, add value to the department and to the students and faculty experience while you're there at Fulbright. So if anything, you would be their mentor. All right. Moving on, we already answered the question about can you apply for more than one. Question about taxes, are the stipends taxable? So you can find all of that information on the Department of State Fulbright webpage. There's a section on taxes. Is it possible to include figures or schemes to clarify and make the project more understandable? Ideally, you would be able to explain it without figures and schemes. The best way to know if that's working for you, we advise all applicants to share their project statement, not only with people in their discipline, but also people external to your discipline. So if you're in a STEM field, share it with somebody who's an English professor. The English professor, the musician, the artist, they should all be able to understand what you're proposing and the relevance in your project, and their, that wow factor should come across regardless of the person's academic training. Okay, we have a question. I think we were getting some questions from someone who's recently graduated. Again, please look at the Fulbright student program, and if you are a student outside of the U.S., there's the Fulbright foreign student program. All right. Okay, we have a question about the language of the syllabi. Keep in mind that everything that you submit in the Fulbright application package should be in English, but if you do have a letter of invitation, and I've seen it several times, we've had letters of invitation in another language, in you know the host country's language, please provide a translation. So if you're able to translate it, or somebody you know is able to translate it, it doesn't need to be an official translation. It needs to be, we just need to be able to have our committee read that in English. If you're listing some works in your bibliography that are not in English, that's fine. But any other formal document, whether it's your invitation letters, your recommendations, all of that we do need to have in English as well. All right. Okay, let's see, we're down to the last 5 minutes, and we still have a load of questions I didn't get to, so please do follow up by attending the office hour or an email. Okay, got to those questions. Okay, let's see. We're having, I see quite a few specific questions. I'm just skipping through those. All right, what is, this is a good question. I think we'll try and end with just these last two. What is the difference between a professional project and a research project? That's a great question. So the professional project is something that's new to the Fulbright program relatively. We introduced it last year for a couple of awards, and we've noticed that a lot of other countries have taken it on. So if you go on our website and type in professional project in the search, you'll get all of the FAQs about this. So essentially, if you are a non-academic and you'd like to conduct research, you would be applying for the professional project. So there's not too much difference, but there's a little more openness, I would say, for professionals in terms of perhaps what they would be doing and you know, the access they'd have to get things done. So research would be, of course, traditional academic research, and a professional project, all of that can be outlined here. All right, so okay. And then we have a question, research for artists often involves field research, in other words, performing, acting, painting, and sculpting. Does this count for research? And the answer is yes. So if you are an artist or a musician, et cetera, and you know, the research you're going to be doing relates to your field, that's fine. Research doesn't necessarily just mean going into the field and conducting interviews or doing tests in the lab. So it can be, you know, working together on a choreography or a composition or things like that, an installation, exhibition. All right. So I think I'll just take one last question and I will sign off. Okay. So we have, let's see, what should I, there's a grab bag of questions to choose from. All right. Does it help to add the affiliation and support offered by the host institution to the proposal? So I'm not quite sure what the question is, but I think what it's going towards, and what I'd like to share is that if you have an invitation letter and they're offering different things to you, whether it's office space or housing or anything, please have them indicate that in the invitation letter and also indicate the communication that you've had with them. Talk about, you know, how your project will align with their objectives and goals, and really talk about that synergy. We should really see at the end of the day, at the end of the project statement, the committee should come away with the thought that, yes, this is a suitable project, it's feasible, it's innovative, and it's relevant to the country, and there will be tangible outcomes and impact. So I'm going to leave you with that. We've hit the 3 o'clock hour. I want to thank you for joining the webinar today. I'm sorry I couldn't get to all of your questions. We have more than 100 people on the line, but please do join an office hour or come in for, you can call me or send in an email. And with that, I will say goodbye and thank you. All the best to you. Good luck.